And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Andrew Howley of Adventure Scientist. And now we welcome science writer David Quammen, whose new book, The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life, explores what began as a theory put forth by evolutionary biologist Carl Woese back in the late 1970s and ultimately has shaped the understanding of life's history on Earth forced by recent discoveries from genome sequencing. To begin with, if you look at Darwin's theory of evolution and the tree of life, for a long time there's been the thought that heredity could jump, say, from limb to limb. Instead, it was believed that heredity only passed downward from ancestor to offspring, never sideways. David Quammen also joins us from Bozeman, Montana, a hotbed of science writing. David, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, John. Thank you. And actually, I'm in Urbana, Illinois right now for a lecture later this afternoon. Not home in Bozeman.
Okay.
That is home.
Good. Okay. For the curious layperson, describe for us what horizontal gene transfer is and why it's important.
Right. Well, horizontal gene transfer is this very surprising, counterintuitive phenomenon whereby, as you suggested, genes move sideways across species boundaries, even from one very different form of life to another, from one kingdom of life to another. It's supposed to be impossible. Heredity, as you said, is supposed to pass downward from ancestors to offspring. But now we know, thanks largely to discoveries from genome sequencing, that genes sometimes jump sideways across species boundaries, which means that the tree of life is not shaped entirely like a tree. There are limbs and branches that move sideways like channels from one limb to another. There's convergence as well as divergence of lineages.
Wow. I was speaking with somebody last week. They were asking me about some of the interesting things we've learned on Cool Science Radio. And I mentioned that this is one of the most surprising things in science that I've learned in a while. First of all, there's two pieces to it. One is horizontal gene transfer, but the other piece is there's a whole new body of a living organism that I had not heard of before, and I hope I pronounce this correctly, the archaea, spelled A-R-C-H-A-E-A. Can you tell us what archaea is and how it differs from, say, bacteria?
Right. It's a whole new kingdom of life, or as they use the term domain, a third great domain of life that was unsuspected to exist before the mid-1970s. You mentioned, I think, my central character, Carl Woese, this fellow at the University of Illinois here in Urbana. That's one of the reasons I'm here today to give a lecture about him. He started in the 1970s trying to trace the history of evolution back a billion years earlier than it had been traced before. And he did that using very primitive, laborious forms of gene sequencing. He started looking at bacteria, sequencing fragments of their genomes. And what he found was there was this large group of creatures, they live mostly in extreme environments like hot pots in Yellowstone Park, that had been taken to be bacteria. They looked through a microscope like bacteria. Single-celled creatures, pretty simple cells, no internal organs, no cell nucleus. But he found by sequencing them that they were drastically different. They are drastically different from bacteria, and not just drastically different, but more similar to us, more similar to animals, plants, complex creatures, all fall within a domain called the eukaryotes. He found that these creatures are more similar to us than they are to bacteria. And it was thought at the time that they might represent descendants of the oldest forms of life on Earth, and that's why they eventually got this name, the archaea. Arch as in archaic, as in archaeology, suggesting old. A third kingdom of life completely unsuspected to exist before Woese's discovery in 1977.
Fascinating. So the fact that you discovered Carl Woese and his work, and I think you call him something like the most important evolutionary biologist who no one knows, basically. You became really obsessed with him, which led to the publication of this book 5 years later. I think it's so interesting that today's technology that has allowed innovation in genome sequencing has really uncovered the work that was done in the late 70s. But then in your book, you even go, you know, far before that. And it's now allowing all this science to surface and really kind of shape our whole, like, understanding of science.
That's right, Lynn. There's been an explosion not only in scientific knowledge, but in methodology. In the years since Carl Woese in the 1970s was doing the first, his first early primitive forms of genome sequencing. And he was doing this within the realm of microbiology and molecular biology pretty quietly here in Urbana, Illinois. I came across this whole field of discoveries just in 2013. I had written probably 3 books about evolutionary biology, Darwin and other things, by then, and I had never heard of Carl Woese. I had never heard of horizontal gene transfer. I had 4 different reasons why I thought that I had learned it was impossible for such things to occur. And then in the spring of 2013, I picked up this thread. Woese himself had just died, so I never met him. And I followed this thread backwards into this whole field that carries the fancy name molecular phylogenetics. And what that means simply is discerning the history of life, the tree of life, phylogeny, how creatures are related to one another, using molecular data, using DNA sequences and the sequence of DNA's cousin molecule, RNA, using those to discern what is related to what else and the shape of the history of life, the tree of life.
So the tree of life, as you say, the title of your book is Tangled, the Tangled Tree. It's kind of like a web, and it shows really that humans are just one of the species. We're all interrelated, and we're all, as I think you point out that Darwin said, you know, we're not above nature, we are part of nature, which is an interesting concept that I think most of us don't really buy into. We think we're above nature.
Right, right. And, you know, I talk about one of Darwin's greatest truths, maybe his darkest truth, was the fact that we humans are part of nature. We are animals. We have evolved from animal lineages like other creatures have. But then along comes Woese and the people who followed him, who were influenced by him and his methods, discovering more than that, that not only are we animals, but we are composites of other kinds of creatures, even we humans. We, for instance, are complex cells contain captured bacteria that have become internal organs. And I'm not talking about the microbiome now. People have heard about the microbiome, all these bacteria that live in our guts and on our skins. Those are part of us in a way, but they're not part of our genomes. But we now know that the human genome contains genes that have come in sideways by different forms of horizontal gene transfer. Even we humans are mosaics in that sense. And as I say near the end of the book, for instance, 8% of the human genome is captured viral DNA. 8% of our genomes are DNA that has come in sideways by infection with retroviruses that inserted themselves, their genomes, into the reproductive cells, eggs, sperm, ovaries, testes of humans, and became heritable.
Wow. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with David Quammen, who has written The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. So back to the point that you're making, 8% of our human genome is viral DNA acquired by infection by retroviruses. They now become part of our... So they're now inherited sideways, and we can now pass them down vertically, up and down, through this tree of life, because it is now in our reproductive cells, and now we can pass this along to our generations. This is pretty heavy stuff, isn't it?
Yes, and it gets even more surprising than that. A large portion of that 8% viral DNA in our genomes seems to be non-functional. It's just there, what scientists used to call junk DNA. It's passed down to our descendants, to our offspring, with now vertically in normal reproduction. It doesn't seem to do anything, at least not anything we know about. But some of it, including one gene studied by a scientist in Paris that I went to see, one gene that was captured from a retrovirus, and in the retrovirus it formed a sort of an envelope, a membrane around the viral particle, now forms a membrane in humans. It's really crucial that that viral DNA is there creating a different kind of membrane, and it's the membrane that intermediates between the placenta and the fetus during human pregnancy. Here's a viral gene creating a boundary layer between the placenta and the fetus that's crucial for carrying nutrients from the placenta into the fetus, carrying waste products from the fetus back out to the placenta so the mother can get rid of them. It's a viral gene that has been adapted and repurposed to this function that's completely necessary to successful human pregnancy.
So just to restate, we wouldn't be here if that didn't happen.
We wouldn't be here if that didn't happen. We wouldn't be here as placental mammals. No placental mammals would be here if there hadn't been earlier captures of retroviruses, there are several different captures that sequentially inserted genes of this sort into the animal genome. It allowed animals to become placental mammals, nurturing their offspring inside their bodies rather than laying eggs. Yes, it seems to be, there's no absolute proof for the necessity yet, but it seems to be necessary that those captures of viral genes were made maybe 80 million, 100 million years ago in order to make possible the rise of placental mammals.
Cost-effective genome sequencing has only been around for a short while now, and we've learned so much. I can only imagine what we're going to learn in the next 20 or 30 years. I mean, this is an opportunity for us to really peel the onion and find out what we're all about.
It's true. It's true. We're finding things out now that not only Charles Darwin wouldn't have dreamed of, but Carl Woese in 1977 wouldn't have dreamed of. I mentioned that his early gene sequencing was primitive and laborious. It involved toxic chemicals and explosive solvents and radioactive phosphorus and high voltage in order to get just a few fragments of a genome of this organism or that organism. The things that Carl Woese did that took him several years of this dangerous, laborious work, a smart undergraduate can now do that much genome sequencing using automated machines in a laboratory in an afternoon. And now we have big, high-powered computers that can analyze that data, compare those genomes one to another. So there's this explosion of surprises and understanding.
Wow. Well, I just have to make a bad joke. As much as I love my kids, laying an egg would have been a lot easier than becoming a placental mammal.
I'm sure. I take your point. I'm sure it would be. And yet there's an advantage to being a placental mammal. If a predator comes and you've laid eggs on the ground in a nest, you can't pick up those eggs and run away with them.
Yeah.
But if you've got your offspring nurturing inside you, then you can run away with the predator and your fetuses go with you.
Oh, good point. Point taken as well. Now I guess I'm happy about that horizontal gene transfer. So, David, could you make a distinction between the sort of virus, say HIV, and horizontal gene transfer, and why we don't pass down to our offspring something like HIV?
Right. People have heard, of course, that HIV is a retrovirus. At least most people have heard of that. What does that mean? Well, it means backward in some sense, retro. It's a virus that patches, that not only infects the cell, but patches its DNA its genome into the genome of the cell that it infects. And then when that cell replicates, it replicates the viral genome, and eventually many viral particles come busting out of that cell. That's what happens with AIDS. A retrovirus infects immune cells. the immune cells that flow in our blood, but it doesn't affect our genome, our reproductive cells. But okay. If a retrovirus, instead of invading the immune cells in a person's body, if that retrovirus invades reproductive cells like eggs, sperm, testes, ovaries, and it inserts its genome into those cells, then when those cells replicate, eggs and sperm become new people, and the retroviral genome is passed on. It becomes hereditary that way.
Okay, that makes sense. So you are widely published. You've written a handful of books. You've written for Harper's, The Atlantic, Rolling Stone, The New York Times, Outside, Powder Magazine, and a regular contributor to National Geographic. You are a science writer bringing science to us lay people out there, hopefully creating the science curious. And I'm wondering if that's why people like Carl Woese were never recognized. They were never known. Their work was never it was published, but not in such a way that could be widely disseminated. And I'm just wondering about, you know, this whole world of work that science writers do, and really you have this really huge obligation.
Well, we do. You're right. And it's also a huge opportunity and a huge privilege.
Yeah.
We are the intermediaries. Carl Woese was, by all accounts, was not a great explainer, not even a very good explainer, a profound scientist who made profound discoveries, but not a good explainer. I'm hearing a beeping. I don't know if that's on your end or just
nope.
Mine. Are you still with me?
Yeah, we're here. We don't hear the beeping.
Okay, well, all right. It's probably just in my brain somewhere, horizontally transmitted. Anyway, Woese was not a great explainer. That's why one of the reasons why nobody has heard of Woese. He didn't write for a popular audience. He wrote scientific articles. And a little bit had been written about him by other science journalists, but not much. That's one of the reasons I seized on him as a, sort of the central character of my book. You know, when you write about science, you need to write about people. People want to read about people. They don't want to read just explanations. They want to read stories. They want to read narratives. Mm-hmm. They want to read about the solving of mysteries by brilliant men and women who do this work. And so we science writers, journalists, or authors of books, we're the ones who come in and tell the stories of the people who make the discoveries and explain the discoveries while we're doing that. And it's great fun. It's a great privilege. It gives you the opportunity to talk to some of the world's smartest people and try and understand what they've discovered and then explain it to all the rest. I know you all have a motto, you know, if we can understand it, you can. I love that because that's absolutely my motto, too.
That's great.
Let's talk about antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The conventional thinking has always been there's a bacterial strain, let's call it A. We're going to treat it with antibiotic, let's call it drug number one. And as the bacteria replicates, it'll mutate and over time will figure out a way to be adaptive to be able to protect itself against the drug. Again, bacteria strain A against drug number one. But that's the conventional thinking. Tell us about what you have learned, what we have learned through horizontal gene transfer.
Well, that's right, John. And what you described is absolutely true, and it's still correct. Bacteria A still slowly, incrementally can evolve a resistance to drug number one. But what we now understand, thanks to initially some scientists in Japan, Tsutomu Watanabe and others, is that once bacteria A has evolved that resistance, it can pass resistance to drug number one sideways to bacteria B, bacteria D, E, and F in an instant by horizontal gene transfer. And not only that, but it can also accumulate by receiving other genes. It might acquire resistance to drug number 2, 3, and 4 by horizontal gene transfer. So now bacteria A has built-in resistance, genetic resistance to drugs 1, 2, 3, and 4. It can pass a package of resistance, those resistance genes, sideways to another bacterium, bacteria M. And so suddenly bacteria M, a different species, a different strain of bacteria, is resistant also to drugs 1, 2, 3, and 4. And that's why the spread of antibiotic resistance is a global health problem, and tens of thousands of people are dying each year from bacterial infections that we used to be able to cure with antibiotics.
And I don't want to take away from the importance of what you just said, but, you know, I see a screenplay here.
And yeah, other people have mentioned that, yeah.
I see a major blockbuster movie with antibiotic-resistant bacteria, HGT, and I don't know. We'll get some other stuff in there too.
Somebody told me that Dwayne Johnson, my favorite cinema actor, The Rock, recently released a movie called Rampage that involves horizontal gene transfer, turning gorillas into gigantic monsters.
Oh wow!
I like that.
Yeah, that's a bit of a stretch, but it's fascinating. So you have, you are a very curious person, and you have a lot of questions about a lot of things. What one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet?
Wow, that is.
It's kind of like Oprah's question. We say, if you were a tree, what kind of tree? Oh, forget it. But
yeah. I guess the ultimate question for me still is, how did life begin? What is the origin of life? Carl Woese's work goes back billions of years to an early point when, before there was even cellular life, before there were bacteria, before there were archaea, and they talk about RNA molecules replicating themselves, and that being perhaps the earliest phenomenon that was lifelike. I'd like to know what the real story was right at the beginning,
right.
how this whole epic narrative got started.
Exactly. David Quammen has written The Tangled Tree, A Radical New History of Life. And, this is not being too dramatic. We are not who we thought we were. So thank you for writing the book, and best of luck in Urbana.
Thank you very much. Great to talk with you both and with your audience.
Okay, David, thank you. We shall return right after these messages. Stay with us.
Hi, this is Roger Goldman, Broadcaster Club member since its inception. There are many unique things about living in Park City. But to really understand not only what's going on from an entertainment perspective, but how the community really works, there is nothing like KPCW and its news and public affairs coverage. I hope you too will be able to join us in the Broadcasters Club.